Attention tadpoles. You are now listening to the host of Where I Belong, the Frog King himself, David Corbo.
All right, 3, 2, 1. Thank you guys for tuning in to another episode of Where I Belong. My guest today is the great Shane Moss. Shane Moss is a stand-up comedian, as well as the host of the Here We Are podcast. And he has just very recently, I think, what was it, March 5th, released a documentary called Psychonautics, A Comedian's Exploration of Psychedelics. Thank you so much, Shane, for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right, man. I kind of wanted to get straight into it. I know we don't have you for a super long time, but I was a huge fan of the documentary. I watched it kind of a silly amount of time. I don't know, maybe like 5 times because...
You watched it 5 times?
It was just fun. Oh, well, wow. To be totally fair, I've got a little nearly 4-year-old boy running around, so there's only so much you can watch in the first sitting, so you kind of revisit
sure,
it.
Sure. Okay.
And it was just a lot of fun. There's not a lot of stuff out there in regards of documentaries. I know one of the ones that I was pretty fond of was like DMT, The Spirit Molecule. I think that's even on Netflix. You know, I think a lot of people have seen that one, but it was a lot of fun. And you did a lot of interesting things in that documentary, and I really wanted to talk about them.
Yeah, awesome. Sounds great.
One of the things that kind of was towards the beginning that really blew my mind. Well, before I get into that, you mentioned that you started doing experimenting with drugs as early as 15 years old. And I think that's a pretty relatable time for a lot of people. You know, I was only 2 years off from that. So I was like 17 when I started messing around with different things. And but you mentioned that I think at some point that if there were a shaman of you and your friends, it would be you just because of the amount of trips that you've had. And I was curious, what was it that you really started with? What kind of things were you experimenting with at 15 years old?
Oh, mushrooms, mostly some LSD. I was just doing them as often as I could get my hands on them, which really wasn't even that much. I wasn't necessarily like one of the in the cool kids clique or whatever. You know, the cool kids would sell me drugs, it was hard to, you know, mushrooms are a difficult thing. At least when I was a teenager, they were a difficult thing to get your hands on. But yeah, I definitely fell in love with them immediately.
When I was younger, me and my friends, we didn't get our hands on mushrooms a lot, but there was a big ecstasy phase. So I've had my fair share of experiences with MDMA, which is interesting because in the documentary, there's a lot of information on that as well. But yeah, psychedelics was never something that we really got to experience very much. And the bummer of it is like, without having any firsthand experience, there's all this like woo-woo surrounding it. You know what I mean? There's always these kind of old wives' tales about each drug. You know what I mean? So you'll hear things like, if you have an orgasm on ecstasy, every orgasm for the rest of your life is going to be, I used to hear that, is going to be ruined.
Yeah.
Because of some level that you're going to attain from ecstasy. And there was always
some weird thing. Just don't come.
Yeah, exactly. You've got to pull out right before then and you know, control yourself. But there was always some sort of thing.
But if you have blue balls on ecstasy, I'm telling you, you'll never have blue balls quite like that again.
So that was kind of the formula.
Yeah.
It'll never be that bad again. I loved the, pretty close to the opening, you and Eric Osborne, right? So you and your buddy Eric Osborne that you met out there,
I didn't even know him until I went out there. I mean, I talked to him on the phone and everything, and I liked what he was doing, and he seemed like an interesting guy, and we weren't really sure what we were doing with the documentary at first, and that was just one of these things that we took a chance on to go and document, and it was I'm glad that we did because it was a real highlight.
It was one of my favorite parts of the documentary because what you guys end up doing is you're going to like a local park and he's showing you how these mushrooms are growing in like common mulch.
Yeah.
Like the mulch that you would see around, you know, any sort of playground or shrubbery or anything like that, that like the Parks and Recs put there. Yeah. They didn't realize that they're inadvertently seeding mushrooms around and growing mycelium. And I thought it was the craziest thing because one of the things about mushrooms that you always hear is like, you can't just go picking any mushrooms because you're going to fucking die. Like every mushroom, that's always, as somebody who's doesn't have any experience with it, that's always what I hear is that, and I believe that is
not bad advice.
Right. You can't go around just picking mushrooms and eating it.
Yeah.
But that is so far removed from the idea that, like, by the way, though, the right ones do grow in mulch that is commonly found, you know, within blocks of anybody's local park or anything like that, which that blew my mind.
I mean, it certainly depends on the region that you're at. It depends, you know, I don't know the I would never feel comfortable picking mushrooms myself. But,
for sure not.
But I know there's definitely, I mean, if you know what you're doing, it's not that hard to find. So, I mean, I live in the Northwest right now and outside of Portland, Oregon. And that's whole, you know, like Paul Stamets, who's like the kind of main
mycologist,
world's leading mycologist, is you know, a couple hours north from me, because that whole region is just like mushroom paradise, and it's just all kinds of mushrooms are springing up everywhere there. So if you know, like, you know what to look for, the right times, once you find your spots and everything like that, it's really not that difficult of a thing to cultivate, is my understanding. I've never done it myself.
Yeah, I think it's probably pretty much like anything. It's like from the outside looking in, you know, but for the initiated, like, it's once you understand the ins and outs, like anything, it becomes pretty easy to figure out and navigate. But it was just, to me, it was just crazy that it was right there. I mean, you made a joke at one point that it wasn't even a joke. It was just an observation. There was a family, like, birthday happening, like, several hundred yards away. And they have no idea that what they're right next to is psychedelic mushrooms. I thought that was incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, they're right in plain sight. What's really interesting is a lot of times mushrooms grow outside of courthouses and outside of jails because people get hauled in and they have spores on them, and then they put a lot of mulch outside of institutions like that, so the spores get into mulch and mycelium grows, and so you know,
that's hilarious.
I don't know what tripping in prison is like.
It's probably terrifying.
I would think so. I mean, I talked to this guy who did some pretty hard time for manufacturing LSD in pretty high quantities. And you know, he was busted like 15, 20 years ago when I think the laws were even less flexible than they are now. And he said, so LSD is about the easiest thing to get into prison because you can just, you know, someone can deliver you a book and every page can just be LSD paper.
Right,
and
right.
So it's not that hard to get LSD into prison. And so I asked him the same. I was like, that sounds terrible to me, tripping it on acid. But he said it was, he said he loved doing acid in prison. I mean,
you want to talk about a psychological escape.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. A lot of times psychedelics make me hyper aware of my life circumstances. So,
yeah.
But, you know, I don't know. Maybe seeing like the bigger picture of things or something. I don't know. I think a LSD trip in prison could be a real scary 12
hours. That sounds
like
a fucking nightmare. I had, when I was watching, you had Dennis McKenna on, and he was talking about set and setting. And to me, it's like, I think about my friends and their horror stories. Because a lot of my friends, I'll bring up the notion of, like, you know, having some sort of an experience with a psychedelic. And every single one of them, hands down, their knee-jerk reaction off the bat is no. And a lot of them had terrible experiences when we were like 16 or 17, But I remember those experiences. I remember looking at them, and we're at a house party, and they've no idea what to anticipate. And then there's like music in the background, and everybody's getting drunk around them, and they're a part of the few elite of our friends who happen to get their hands on acid or something at the time. And they just spiral downward and have this horrible trip. And ever since then, they're all scared and scarred. And, you know, it just speaks to, like, I couldn't imagine doing it in prison. Prison sounds like a nightmare. Being in a cage, you know, it's just nothing but existential dread all the time about your lack of freedom. And now you're going to do something that's going to amplify that. But I mean,
plus
maybe
it's, it's doing the thing that you went to prison for, too.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a solid point. Layer. Yeah, it's that, you know, but that also speaks to kind of the illegality of it. And it's like, because it's illegal, there's no education on it. So any experience that you have with it is going to be bad, you know, sevenfold, because you're going to have a bad trip because you don't know what you're doing. And you're going to have a bad experience purchasing it in the first place because you've got to do it, you know, by some shady means. And
yeah.
Then there's layers of guilt and all this other crazy crap, when it seems like potentially, I mean, you know, it's something that I wanted to touch on, but every one of these substances that you go over in the documentary seems to have a different little niche that it could potentially help with.
Yeah.
But you shroud it in illegality, and it's doing nothing but freaking people the fuck out. And then it's, you know, it's sending them down dark alleyways to get it in the first place. And it's riddling them with paranoia for having done it. And it's a nightmare.
Yeah. Eric Osborne, I think, you know, he's been pretty open about this story, so I think I'm okay to tell it, but he is the guy in my documentary who he has legal psilocybin retreats in Jamaica, so where psilocybin is legal. And he runs one of the world's only psilocybin retreats, and it's called Mycometeditations. It's fantastic. I've gone down there to help facilitate people's trips a few times. I'm going again in a couple weeks, and he's been guiding people on trips and has been doing mycology, not just psilocybin mushrooms, but other mushrooms for a number of years. And he used to guide groups of people. He would just like go out to this farmland that he had, and he would take everyone's keys, you know, and like people that have tents and everything. And someone in one of his retreats freaked out. And then they had a second set of keys for their car, and they snuck off and drove away, and then ended up getting in a car accident. It wasn't serious. Like, there's no injuries or anything. But the police showed up, and then that's how he ended up getting busted. He ended up going to jail for giving mushrooms to people, and was on probation for a while. He had just finished probation at the time we did the documentary. And so, you know, that was him, you know, a pretty professional guy doing things in a pretty safe manner. And still, you know, someone just having a second set of keys and all of that, setting is really important, and things can go wrong with this stuff. That's why, you know, my hope and my dream for this stuff, and I think MDMA is well on its way to being legalized for clinical settings. But I would love for it to go back to the kind of clinical settings where you're in a clinical office with professionals that can guide you through it. And
insurance.
Yeah. And I mean, I think after people have some trips under their belt, I think there is a lot of value in being out in nature sometimes, or even tripping by yourself, and even going to a concert. These are all things that can potentially be be a little toward the riskier side and cause more problems. But the main reason for that is because you know, people just don't know what they're doing in the first place. And maybe this is their first experience ever. And they do something like MDMA that is, you know, terrific for, you know, the MAPS organization, the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies. Their studies are in phase three, the last phase with their MDMA research for PTSD. And their trials have shown more success and promise than anything else on the market, so much so that the FDA has given them breakthrough status, meaning that the results so far in their studies have been so promising that it's unethical to keep this potential treatment from people who need it. So the FDA is actually having to help along the organization to speed along this process because they're seeing that lots of people can benefit from this stuff. Now you take something like that, that's showing this, you know, 65% of people a year later no longer have PTSD. About 99% of people are benefiting from it. It's just some of them still have some PTSD, less so than they had when they started the study. But nothing else on the market is working like nearly 100% of the time like it is here. Now you take something like that is nearly 100% effective. Yeah,
I was just going to say that, nearly 100%.
It's showing so much promise, but it's done in the right set and setting. And you contrast that with how MDMA can be used poorly, which is, you know, people are going to a rave, they're not testing their drugs. Even if you're testing drugs, it's just testing for that MDMA is in there. So it doesn't necessarily, it's not even, depending on the test that you're getting, they're not telling you what else is potentially in there. So it's just saying like, hey, there is some MDMA in here. It's not saying that it's like a 100% pure MDMA or anything like that. I think someone said in the documentary, there's a lot of adulterates out there. There's a lot of bath salts being passed off as MDMA. And then people are in these settings. They're in these hot nightclubs that are charging $10 for a bottle of water. And you got these kids that don't want to pay that for a bottle of water. And they're dancing themselves into a stupor and getting heat exhaustion on this poor quality product. And so you can have what is supposed to be, you know, the same drug in two completely different set and settings, and one being like a miracle and another being a nightmare. And so, I do believe that if you start with the clinical setting, you know, maybe once you really get to know yourself and have experience with that, then, you know, maybe in the future you can. But if you know what you're doing and you know the importance of having the right amount of water and even salt in your diet with MDMA, so you don't flush out. Some people drink too much water on MDMA and flush all the salt from their system. There's problems there too. So this is stuff that your average, you know, college student doesn't know. But having even a clinical setting to even have like the proper training in, and who knows, you know, you might have this wonderful experience at a rave on MDMA, and there's no reason why people shouldn't have the opportunity to have that. There's so much, you know, kind of, so much of our modern medicine is about like fixing these ailments and like, what's wrong with people, and we need to fix what's wrong with people, and you don't hear a lot about like, well, there's also you know, a lot of benefits in having a really great time. Like you can also have this really beautiful experience out camping with your buddies that can also be incredibly therapeutic. Without you know, having it be this difficult, hard thing where you're exploring your past childhood trauma or whatever as well. Yeah. And those are equally valid experiences. It's just that the current model, the current environment that we're living in, the way the laws are, it makes it dangerous for those kind of recreational environments.
One of the things that I noticed, speaking of MDMA, was that I believe it was a scientist on the documentary that was saying that the effects that it has are such that it almost temporarily shuts down the part of the brain that would typically keep you from thinking about painful memories and talking about them. And that's why it's so effective with people who have PTSD, and it allows them to explore potentially traumatic memories and talk about them in a way that doesn't cause them any further trauma. And it's like, you know, that's got to be, I imagine, the reason that they're pushing it forward so much is because so much of it, I mean, it's like I heard multiple times in the documentary, is it doesn't necessarily, it's not like it fixes a chemical imbalance. It gives you an experience or the ability to talk about something or a memory to look back on that kind of course corrects the ship for a while. So it's not like something you have to continuously take because of a chemical imbalance that you may or may not have. It's an experience that you have that changes your perspective. It allows you to look at things differently. And that is, you know, it's so counter to what the pharmaceutical industry is right now, because it's so much of it is you've got this chemical imbalance, which I don't want to speak out of line, but I from my understanding, so many things like you know, ADHD or anything like that, they don't have a scientific experiment that they've performed that'll give you a sample or numbers on a chart that'll show you where the deficit is, where the brain chemical is lacking. Because that's always the thing, as somebody who's not, you know, I don't really take anything. I've had a history of ADHD, but other than that, and when I was younger, they told my mother it was just a chemical imbalance and that Adderall was going to fix that. And I don't remember being shown anything. I just did a math quiz in front of my mother and the doctor. And then my inability to focus on the math quiz because they're talking about me in front of me. And I don't know how old I was, maybe like 11 or something like that. So you're talking about an 11-year-old in front of the 11-year-old and having them do a math quiz. And I just couldn't focus on it. I couldn't do it. And so they gave me these pills. But so much of our industry is focused on correcting some imbalance and fixing a thing. And then over here, there's this entire spectrum of substances that give you meaningful experiences. And those meaningful experiences allow you to explore yourself and understand yourself better in a lot of circumstances. And they change your perspective for the long run sometimes. And that sounds so counter what the industry is right now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a lot in what you just said there. So I'll break that into pieces a little bit. One, I mean, there's definitely a lot of scientific research being done into ADHD and things like that. And it's just that, definitely it seems like there's a pharmaceutical push to, there's a lot of profit to be made and kind of over-diagnosing these conditions, because some of these treatments do work well with kids that are really struggling a lot. But you take something like antidepressants, which weren't tested for a long time on female rats or female subjects, because the ovulatory cycle makes the data a little bit harder to test, and so it's easier just to not test, say, a female rat that cycles every 4 days. But females experience depression more than males do, and they experience it differently than males do as well. And so to be testing a product on, say, on male rats and then male humans that is going to be predominantly used for females, you know, there's a long history of that, where that's a really, you know, fortunately some of that's being corrected now, because that's a very backwards way of doing things, just to save a few bucks. And then, you know, something like antidepressants, where they kind of like, okay, well, maybe it seems like it has something to do with serotonin, but is it too much serotonin? Is it too little serotonin? Is it, is it that there's not enough serotonin being expressed in the first place, and enough serotonin neurotransmitters being released in the first place, or is it that the serotonin receptors, something's inhibiting them, or is it this reuptake inhibitor that's getting blocked? And so they don't even know what the pill itself is doing or acting on. And so to do something where you're taking a pill, you know, every single day and changing someone's brain chemistry, not to mention that ADHD and depression might very well just be a mismatch with our modern world, where kids aren't really, we didn't evolve to be sitting in desks for 8 hours a day in our childhood, and depression is a lot of depression as a result of our modern inactivity. So there's things like that, but at the same time, there is some fantastic, and there's terrific being there is, for all my distrust in a lot of pharmaceutical, there is a lot of, you know, fantastic science being done. It's just a long ways from knowing what's going on, where for something that you're taking every day, whereas they do, it seems like they have a better sense of what's going on with PTSD and MDMA. So you have for PTSD, you have this traumatic experience. Say you're in a war, a bomb goes off next to you, and your amygdala lights up and it says, holy shit, we just went through a real close call, a whole ordeal. You see body parts being blown off or whatever else. This is traumatizing, and this is it's a painful thing to even remember. And what happens is that your brain, a part of your brain, is like, hey, you better remember that things can explode next to you sometimes, so keep an eye out for that. You know, this is why we have these fear responses and these stress responses, is so that we learn the dangers of our world and the dangers of our environment. But sometimes there's nothing in our brain to signal to us that, like, hey, you're not at war anymore. You don't really need to worry about roadside bombs or whatever, because now you're in Toledo, Ohio, you know? But what happens is a segment of that population that goes through that traumatic experience, they never have a chance to deal with it and talk about it. A lot of times, you know, troops don't want to, like, you know, bitch about their problems, or they're told to pull up their bootstraps, or they think it's like a disservice to the people that were lost and sacrificed their lives to complain about. Here they are living, and to sit around whining about their lives seems unfair. And so they don't do the proper therapeutic treatment. And then, you know, over time, the brain keeps on going like, hey, remember this experience? And they're like, no, I don't want to think about that. And you're trying to push it away. And you have this oversensitive amygdala, this overactive amygdala, and so now you get triggered when you're in a grocery store line and someone, like, kind of bumps their card into you or something like that, and all of a sudden you have this flashback and this is really intense experience for a lot of people. And what the MDMA is seemingly doing is inhibiting the amygdala, which is the major player in your kind of fight or flight response. And then it's also increasing blood flow to the prefrontal cortex, which is a lot of your decision making and a lot of your higher executive functions. I have a science podcast called Here We Are, and we talk a lot about this stuff, and neuroscience is definitely not my strong suit, but I'm doing my best to regurgitate what the experts have told me. So what you're able to do in that condition is you've dampened your fear response, and now you're able to think through this past experience in an almost more thoughtful way than you usually can, and a less fearful way. And so it's a lot of this is about kind of gaining closure on these experiences. A lot of what the psychedelic experience is for me, and now this isn't, no scientist has ever told me this. This isn't fact, but this is just the my take on what's going on is there's kind of this, you know, you have your subconscious world and your conscious world, and they're kind of trying to communicate to one another and kind of speaking two different languages. You're sitting here and going, hey, brain, I would like to exercise. And your subconscious is communicating to you through, not through this complicated language stuff, but through these different emotions and feelings. And my brain's going, I feel like sitting in this bed and not going for a jog right now. And they're not really seeing eye to eye, and there's some kind of mixed signals there. And not to mention, I think it is more complicated than that too, where we all wear these many hats in our lives too. And I think that there's kind of this inner conflict within ourselves all of the time of these different roles that we play in life, kind of bidding for our conscious attention. And so what happens in the psychedelic experience, in my opinion, is that it kind of opens up the layers of communication. And so you kind of, all of a sudden, you're kind of able to talk with yourself in this clearer way that, because a lot of the stuff that comes out of these experiences, you try to tell people, like, and it sounds silly. It sounds like, you know, the takeaway from a lot of your psychedelic experience is like, oh, I realized I just gotta like be myself or whatever. You know, it sounds like something that's already written on like anyone's grandma's decorative pillow, right, or something. Like, I get it now. Home is where the heart is.
Yeah, yeah. You've got to love everybody and treat everyone as equals.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like this kind of boring bit of information, but there is absolutely a difference between intellectually knowing something and telling yourself something and kind of knowing how you should behave and then feeling it and like being able to put it into practice. Those are two very different things, and that's a lot of the usefulness of the psychedelic experience, in my opinion. And so I think that's where a lot of this closure is coming from, is people with, you know, I don't have PTSD. I can't pretend to, speak for anyone with PTSD or what they're going through. You know, I'm trying my best to accurately portray the research as I know it. But it seems to me that people are able to all of a sudden process and talk to their kind of subconscious and be like, hey, we're not at war anymore. We don't need to, not everyone is, there's not someone like hiding in a bush everywhere you look. There's not a landmine, a potential landmine in every step through life in this environment. And it's able to gain closure with that. I imagine it doesn't mean someone's life's going to be hunky dory afterwards. You still went through.
But it is the beginning. It's learning to cope with it. It's like the difference between knowing a thing and internalizing it. And it's so many of these experiences are like epiphanous moments where you suddenly internalize the knowledge because you know that you're not at war, I imagine, logically, but suddenly you feel that inside. You know that. There's a difference between like knowing it and knowing it, right? But even if you don't have PTSD, it's like, in my experience, what happens is oversharing. You know, suddenly you're just willing to delve into all of these, you know, I mean, it's every time it's happened with me. It's like sharing childhood stories, having these brief little epiphanous moments about maybe that's why I'm like that, or maybe that's why I have a tendency to do these things, or, you know, I'm averse to talking about this or that. It always seems to happen that way. MDMA is just kind of the oversharing drug in my experience, you know, with people that don't have PTSD, me and just my goofy ass friends who are talking about, you know, childhood and relationships and things like that. But, you know, in life without MDMA in your system, I'm much less likely to go deep. I mean, it was, you know, there's this image that I was always fed of, like you mentioned, the rave, right? And the thumping music, that's been associated very much so with MDMA. I've never had that experience. It's only ever been me sitting, you know, in a living room with a bunch of friends, and nobody will shut the hell up, and they're all telling and if for some reason you care at that moment about your friend's shitty life and the things that they've experienced, you genuinely do care. Whereas if you tried to sit down across from me and tell me that in waking life, I could maybe deal with one, but not like five or six people all cross-referencing and shouting across each other about their lives. And but in that moment, you do care. So I've never experienced, well, actually, I have experienced something bad one time, which was I had a buddy that was in another room that was striking keys on an electric keyboard. And so he's holding these tones. Boop, beep. And some, for some reason, these tones are making me think, and I had also been drinking, which I would never recommend, but I did that in my younger years. Sure. I was drinking with it. And so whatever cocktail of crap that I was on caused me to have this like negative experience where everything that I couldn't not think of things that were negative. And every time I tried to think of something that made me happy, something terrible would happen to us. If I thought of puppies, I'd be like, oh, puppies make me happy. I'm laying on a couch with my eyes closed, trying to ignore the electric keyboard. And then I'm thinking of puppies and the puppies are just exploding. And I have to go on now. Puppies are ruined for me. And I have to go on to the next thing and the next thing. And it all resulted in like me thinking of my mom, like my mom makes me happy. And then she fucking explodes. Yeah. And now I stood up and I was, you know, I went to my buddy and I was like, we got to get the hell out of here. So we took a walk and got out at like 4 a.m. But it is, you know, it's just funny because like I said before, how it doesn't suit the pharmaceutical machine, the pharmaceutical industry, the way that it's set up. And one of the other reasons is because it's not a thing that you constantly have to take. And so you have to keep filling up your prescription. You know what I mean? You could do it once and not do it for a very long time afterwards. And so as far as financial gain, it's not really there. You know, to set up an industry around it and to have people become successful in their lives or more successful and happier in their lives, sure, that trickles down into society, right? And therefore society becomes more successful at large. But as far as the immediate financial gain, it's just not really there.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely it seems like there is this is what some of these experiences allow for is something that our brains definitely need. I don't know what our past evolutionary, if our hunter-gatherer ancestors shared more of their feelings than we currently do. It seems like they were a little more expressive. I don't know if this is a product of our isolated world now where we tend to kind of repress things and we're very cautious about the things that we share with one another, but clearly brains really need to kind of verbalize things and share these things with others and work through them. And this is, I imagine this is why podcasts are a popular thing and why, but not everyone can have a podcast. Well, anyone can have a podcast actually, but not everyone's going to get on stage and be a stand-up comic where you kind of get paid to make yourself vulnerable and share all your deepest, darkest secrets and all of that thing. And you know, people still have these aversions to therapy. And we still a lot of people are still in climates like my hometown where no one really talks about much of anything other than, you know, you keep it to the sports and the weather and you have this very safe conversation and it's this clear thing that is like trying to come out of anybody, because you get someone drunk and you take your toughest, most grizzled guy who doesn't share his feelings, and you know, you get them drunk enough, which inhibits the prefrontal cortex, and the prefrontal cortex has a lot of impulse control, and it's kind of that limiter, that filter. And you strip that filter off, and all of a sudden, if people start pouring their hearts out, well, they do it in this way where they were intoxicated and probably, butchered everything that they actually wanted to try to express, and right, maybe did make an ass out of themselves. And now now they regret it the next day, and then it's this kind of cyclical thing. Whereas you don't hear as much of that on MDMA. I mean, I've had some embarrassing shares on MDMA before, where I'm like, oh, that might have been a little bit of an overshare last night,
right?
But it seems like that's not the case as often as something like alcohol, and it seems like maybe, I mean, you know, maybe if we just lived in a more open society to start with, there wouldn't be much of a need. There wouldn't be as much of a need for any of these experiences in the first place. But we live in the world that we live in, and I do think that psychedelics are a potential catalyst for change in regards to creating a more open, empathetic, caring society that is still, we can care about one another and share our feelings and everything without being a bunch of naive suckers or being taken right. advantage of and still doing it in an intellectual way. You know, it's not that scary to make yourself a little bit vulnerable, and often people really respect that, and often we all learn from it.
And it makes communication easier.
Yeah, it really does. So there's been a lot of one of I think the most promising things about psychedelics, studies with psychedelics, and these aren't big studies. Hopefully these will be replicated in larger sample sizes in the future. But it seems as if the factor of openness, which is kind of one of the big five personality traits that psychologists sometimes like to measure, which is kind of the predictor of openness is the biggest predictor of kind of your willingness to new experiences, your natural curiosity, your openness to others and to different people, different experiences, and your resilience to new challenges is this openness, and it seems that in some studies it seems to show that people that have had a single psychedelic experience will, for the average person, make them rate higher in openness for at least a year, if not the rest of their lives. And so this is kind of what you saw come out of the 60s, which, you know, everyone talking about peace and love and all that. But you saw a lot of great stuff with civil rights and everything else come out of that time, and the empowerment of females and everything else. And so, I think that psychedelics show some pretty clear promise in terms of creating a less fearful population of people and a more open society.
Right. I hope this is a good segue, but it's interesting that you should mention, our historical relationship with psychedelics, because one of the things that I had hoped to ask you was, I was listening to your podcast, Here We Are, and it was one of the more recent episodes, and you had a language expert on. And I was just curious about your thoughts on I think it's Terence McKenna's theory, the stoned ape theory, and the idea that we developed cognitively because of our relationship with mushrooms.
It was even kind of hinted at in my documentary as well. You know, I would say that, did we evolve alongside these different psychoactive substances? Surely our ancestors were putting all sorts of weird things in their mouths and experimenting with all sorts of stuff. and you know, by evidence that we have this stuff. People have been consuming alcohol and tobacco and coca leaves and things like that for a very long time. And no doubt people have been getting into mushrooms and potentially ayahuasca and other stuff like that for, I mean, people think it's like some crazy miracle that ayahuasca has these two different ingredients that you combine them and you have ayahuasca. Well, but on their own, they don't do much. And so how did they learn to put these two together? Like, was it from aliens or something like that? And really, it's not, it's probably a simpler story than that, which is that one of the vines is a MAOI inhibitor and boiling, chewing on this thing, which it wasn't that unheard of for our ancestors to gnaw on bark or whatever else had any kind of nourishment, especially when desperate. And there's MAOI inhibitor, which would elevate your mood a little bit. And then once you find this thing that elevates your mood a little bit, you start mixing it with all sorts of different things, which it is. It's mixed with a lot of different substances around Peru, not just to form ayahuasca. And so you can kind of see the natural progression of some of this stuff. You can see, I mean, there's birds that get drunk. You can see videos of this, that you see berries that are that get fermented because a frost comes in early, and these birds
aren't there. Jaguars in the jungle, I heard, that are eating there's examples of them eating some sort of a psychedelic plant and tripping.
Yeah, I mean, and these things are potentially, you know, in small doses, potentially increasing vision. I mean, I've certainly had that experience on LSD, and they give people eye exam charts on like a one hit, like an average kind of small dose of LSD, and people do better on eye exams on a hit of acid. So you have, and acid's new, but the I'm forgetting the plant that's similar to it that's pretty old. I think it's a flower, but you know, if you get into something that makes you see a little bit better and potentially makes you a little bit better at hunting, and then the next logical step is you indulge a little too much in this stuff, then you have this insane psychedelic experience. I mean, I think that having an accidental psychedelic experience would, you know, it foster a lot of introspection and potentially, you know, it seems like you're connecting with these different worlds. You know, if you're taking a lot of these substances and now babbling about these different worlds that you're seeing,
right,
you might, you know, back before psychosis was such a stigmatized thing, this might be, you know, this is often like the leaders of communities where
the people, shamans, right?
Yeah. And so I don't think it's that far-fetched that something like that happened. I don't know how big of a player psychedelics were in our evolutionary history. I don't know if we would have been just as far along now with or without psychedelics. I mean, it seems reasonable to think that we could have evolved just as well without them, but they could have, the stone date theory could be correct. You know, it's a just so story. I would say it's such a fun story to think
it
about.
Is.
That,
it is.
That it's, you know, a lot of times the truth of the matter is that things aren't as fun as stories like that usually.
There's probably a gray area, middle ground somewhere. Yeah. It's like it did. It wasn't that profound. It wasn't responsible for the whatever the doubling of the human brain or whatever the number is. But, you know, it had a hand. It was a symbiotic relationship. I was at work and I had this guy come up to me, and he was he just became a Christian. And he was asking me about a bunch of things, like, oh, if you're not Christian, or because I'm agnostic, I just don't know. I've had not not had any experiences myself, and so I really don't know. But you know, if you're not subscribing to Christianity or something like that, where do you get your morals from? And it's like a weird question. But one of the things we ended up talking about was I mentioned that the way I see it, there's a huge likelihood that before religion, some form of early man had an experience with a psychedelic and then tried to verbalize or you know, later on in our evolution, write down that experience. And then that turns into religious text and everything. And I just wanted to know, what are your opinions on things like, you know, I know there's a book called The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, and it talks about Christianity and its early stages deriving from psilocybic mushroom use. And I just feel, to me, that feels like it makes so much sense, you know, because it's the only thing that I know of that you can do that is available today that'll give you an experience, like you mentioned, ayahuasca, or people that have smoked DMT will give you this profound experience. Will oftentimes you'll feel like you've communicated with a being, and it, you know, to me, it's like if you were to have that experience in the days of early Christianity, that's God, you know, as far as I would see it.
Yeah, I mean, and potentially more recently, one of my favorite ones. Again, I'll tell it because it's fun, not because it's necessarily true. But it is a fun kind of just so story. And I don't one thing listeners should know is I don't sit around doing a lot of psychedelic research. I've done lots of psychedelics. I have a lot of experience, but I've actually avoided psychedelic research on the whole because I like to have my own experiences and kind of figure out my own way of thinking about them. And I don't always buy into some of the other theories that are out there, and I don't like them influencing my experiences. Also, my science podcast, Here We Are, psychedelics is a tiny little sliver of right. It. And so I have lots of other fields that I'm busy studying. I made a documentary. Sometimes people think I'm like some authority on psychedelics, and I don't consider myself an authority on psychedelics at all. Always do your own research, but I like talking about them, and I like regurgitating other people's fun theories.
That's my favorite thing to do.
So, you know, there's this Amanita muscaria mushroom, which they think is potentially related to the Santa Claus story. And off the top of my head, I'll try to relate some of the parallels as I remember them. So Amanita muscaria is this big, kind of beautiful red and white mushroom. Apparently, if you boil it or you do it in some particular way, you have this kind of waking dream experience. I've experimented with Amanita muscaria a little bit. I feel like I have had a little bit of a waking dream experience. It was very strange. It was unlike any other trip that I've ever had. But I was also drunk at the time. And so that'll mess with things. I don't drink anymore, by the way, but Amanita muscaria, so it's this big red and white mushroom, and these Siberian reindeer herders, it grows under conifer trees, which are like Christmas trees. The shaman that eat this stuff usually you've seen like shamans like sit in a hut and like sit and like shake their like tambourines or whatever like their maracas or whatever they might have, and their version of that is they sit on like a reindeer pelt and shake bells. So they're sitting on a reindeer belt. They're like shaking like bells, like sleigh bells.
Okay.
And they also, so they grow under what are Christmas trees. They would, to dry them out, they would string them in these trees. So they'd be like decorating with these
decorating
red and white mushrooms. And then also they would, so they would store them up in the winter time and winter solstice.
In little boxes with bows on them?
Well, they carried them around in big sacks on sleighs. So people would often be snowed into their huts. So during winter solstice, this is, you know, no one knows. Well, first off, we don't know if there actually was a guy named Jesus, but we certainly don't know when his birthday was. There was winter solstice already existed before Christianity. And so Christianity kind of co-opted that time.
Right.
People were already celebrating and made it about Jesus. You know, there's a lot of holidays around that time, and there's a lot of reasons to, have feasts at that time to kind of keep up with keep community spirits up and everything. This is traditionally a hard time when people are hunkered down and everything else. Well, so people are often hunkered down in these huts that, you know, you're in Siberia and you're snowed in and they couldn't open their front door. So they would often go around with these sacks and drop these Amanita muscaria mushrooms down people's chimneys to deliver them because the doors would be too snowed in to get out. Some of this stuff doesn't make too much sense to me because it's like, well, how did they shit then? How did they go to the bathroom?
Just in but the corner, a shit corner.
But who knows? But I guess they would, their traditional shaman dress, they would dress up like the mushroom. So they would,
oh my God,
dress up in red and white and have like these mushroom looking buttons on their chest and everything and go around and deliver these packages of these experiences down these chimneys. And there's more examples than that. But the idea is that when Europeans ventured into there, they just kind of appropriated some of those traditions, made them their own. And that's the origins of the story of Santa Claus. Now, people hear that and they're like, well, that's crazy. That's not where the... Well, then you tell me where the Santa Claus story came from.
Do you ever... Christmas is one of those things.
It's a crazy fucking story, no matter where it came from.
Right.
Any story that you have is going to be a crazy one. You have some story about some fat man that lives in the North Pole that's flying around delivering presents to... I mean,
what does it have to do with Jesus?
Story. Yeah, you're just used to that story. It doesn't have, it's no less or more crazy than the reindeer story. And in fact, the Amanita muscaria story makes a lot more sense.
Right.
Creating this story out of thin air from nothing. All these stories come from nowhere, from somewhere, and this is how the game of telephone works.
It evolves over time.
Yeah.
That's such a cool idea that there's like these holidays that we have that originally started off as worshiping of some psychedelic. That is, to me, that's one of the coolest concepts. But this Christmas is one of those things where it's like, I swear to God, every year I'm seeing a new article about the origins of Christmas, whether it's like Krampus or some shit like that, this giant demon Santa Claus from like Norway or something like that. There's always Krampus was like, you know, the punisher of bad children. And he would show up on Christmas and he would bring you gifts if you were good, but if you were bad, he would fillet you or some terrible thing. And he looked like, you know, like a Baphomet, that would come down the chimney. But yeah, you hear things like that and who knows how much of it could be verified, right? You said some of it's a little weird, like how do they take a dump and everything else like that. Some of that is so compelling. Most of that is so compelling. I couldn't look at that and think that that was crazy. I mean, it just makes a shit ton of sense.
Well, you go sharing that story with people that aren't into psychedelics.
Yeah, the Christmas table.
Yeah. And see the reaction you get. I think another thing was, if I'm remembering right, there. So Amanita muscaria, they are not a mushroom that you want to just grab and just start gobbling. It comes along with a lot of stomach pains and everything else, but there's a way of processing, like if you feed them to reindeer and collect the reindeer's urine. It works as this filtration system, and then you drink the urine, and it's this way of doing it without getting sick. But you think that drinking urine would make you more sick, but apparently when you've gotten the good mushrooms, the reindeers jump up and down a lot. Like,
right.
Reindeer.
Right, exactly. So, there's an endless amount of connections there.
Yeah.
I got about a half an hour left at the end. I wanted to kind of go over some funky stuff because, one of the things that we didn't touch on, though, that I do want to say is that in the documentary,
I hate to be rude. Do you edit this? Because I was wondering if we could just pause for a second, if I could run to the bathroom. Or is No. All right, that's fine. I'll power through.
We'll get an hour. Just hold it. Just tie it in a knot. We'll be ready. All right. I appreciate
it. No problem.
But one of the things that I did want to say before I move on is that there is a part of your documentary where they talked about, like we said, MDMA that they're using to treat people with PTSD and to help them as a coping mechanism. But there's also a bit on psilocybin and its use in depression. And so there's all these various substances that are so, the propaganda of the 60s kind of demonized these things. And yet psychologically, they're these massive helps to us. But what I do want to move on a little bit to is some of the crazier experiences that you talked about, because like we said, MDMA and such, psilocybin, those things are great for a lot of things. And then there's some funkier ones, like you did ketamine, which I thought was really cool because you did it in a clinical setting, which I don't know. I wasn't even aware that that was really a thing, that you can go and have a ketamine experience with a trained professional. But one of the things that you said while you were having that experience was that somehow you get this feeling of responsibility, but responsibility in the sense of like you're responsible for everything, like the ugly and the universe and the world and things of that nature, almost like this feeling of being God, like or this connectedness to a being that is God. Like what could you elaborate a little bit on that? Because that was really interesting.
I think these disassociative experiences. This isn't what I intellectually believe is happening, but
it was a feeling, not a sensation.
The feeling, the experience some of these disassociatives, like in particular DMT and ketamine, which I only did ketamine once in the documentary. I haven't done it since. That's the one I'd really like to experiment with more. Definitely there's this, and this is not just me, a lot of people kind of report this same thing, of this feeling of connectedness, feeling of being at one with everything, and we are all one, and this is all one thing that we're a part of, which, I mean, to break this down in a less woo-hoo-y, but still, it can be a little out there for a lot of people. I guess the easiest way to rectify some of this in an intellectual way for me is just kind of putting it in terms of a simulation theory. I mean, it's not unlikely that we're living in a simulation. It might be depending on how you look at it. It seems like it's probably the case. It seems like that's the inevitable conclusion of something existing, is that it eventually gains more and more complexity. And as us humans, as we've gained complexity, what do we like to do? We like to test things. We like to form models. We build programs. We build simulations.
Right.
And we're pretty simple primates, we're pretty young species, still aren't in our infancy. Science is pretty new. Computers are exceptionally new. The simulations that we're making are like really, really, really brand new in the scope of time. I mean, the universe has existed for about 12 billion years, life on this planet about 4.5 billion years. We've had computers for about 20 years or so. You really can't underestimate how new a lot of this stuff is. And right. If you look at what we're already doing, which is we're already creating these, I mean, there's I can't remember the name of it, but it's kind of like a game, I guess. I've never played it myself. I just know of it. That is, they took all of the astrological data and information and built our universe inside this game that then you can like go around and fly around inside of a simulation of our universe. And this is so done so well that astronomers and physicists have actually learned things about our universe from making observations within this game, within this simulation. And that's what we're doing at the very infancy of having these things. What are the chances that there's not something that is more advanced than us that already did this, and that's what we're already living in now? It seems unrealistic that we aren't living in a simulation, as unsettling as that might be for people. Now take a simulation and imagine you're playing Sims, and imagine you have the processing power and whatever programming know-how to kind of give these individual lives within this computer game, within your World of Warcraft or whatever. You can give them kind of their own sentience. You can give them their own kind of self-awareness at some level, and this would make all sorts of sense to do, even in a self-evolving program where this character, this avatar, becomes very aware of this world and then becomes aware. So now you don't need to control it anymore because it's on its own. It already knows what to do. It has its instincts programmed in, and it knows to go off and like do this mining or whatever that's for you, or going to war or whatever else. And it kind of has its own consciousness. Well, if you still looked at so from this thing's point of view, it would seem like our lives. It would seem like it's looking around in this world. It would be kind of indifferent from our experience. But for us, the programmers of this world, we can look at the stream of code that is going through all of this and running all of this, and that stream of code all exists like to anyone that doesn't know what they're looking at, this would look like all just one string of code and indifferential code. And so it's like all one, that is all one thing. It's all one program. It's all one game or simulation that this is existing within. And so now imagine there's like some sort of substance or something like that within this simulation
that makes you aware of the code.
That makes you aware of the code, and then you see that it's all connected, and you're all connected to everything. And that's the closest. I've spent a number of years now trying to figure out how to explain these things in a way that makes sense to people and that is accessible to people. But that concept, that's kind of the feeling of it when you're in this experience. That's what it feels like for me.
And it's a strange thing to even put into words, though, because to say that I have a feeling that I have glimpsed the code that we're all connected to, like, what the fuck does that even feel like? You know what? It's just a weird thing to say. It's a feeling, because I sometimes kick around the eye of like the idea of deja vu, and I say like deja vu is the only thing where you feel like you have existed in this time before. It's a very strange, it happens to us all, and so we pay it no mind. But when you stop and think about, you suddenly were struck with the sensation that you have repeated a moment in time. That's fucking bizarre. nobody ever really, I mean, it, you know, kind of you think about it, but there's, it's a dead end very quickly. There's not much anything else to expand on. And so you just go on about living your day. But that's a very strange sensation to have that a lot of people don't really seem to think about. So when you say things like, I have the sensation or the feeling that I've glimpsed the code that we are all, everything in this universe is a part of, is, you know, it's a crazy thing to say when you put, to try to put it into words. And one of the other things that really gets me is, like, it seems to me whenever people have these experiences of DMT or ayahuasca or anything, something really profound happens, it's a constant battle of trying to even put it into words. And we haven't figured that out yet. Like, nobody has really elegantly explained it in a way. They say you don't really understand a thing until you can explain it simply, right? And it's like nobody's come back and explained in a way that people can grasp. And it's always seems to be this mission of like, how the fuck do I explain this?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think everything is needs a simple explanation to be understood necessarily. I think that's that was like a that's like a made up Einstein quote that people throw around that I don't think he actually said.
I believe that.
but yeah, I mean, I think that a lot, there's a lot of people making some headway. You know, I would like to think that I did an okay job of over the course of my tour and 2.5 hour one man show of putting these things into words. I spent a lot of time explaining them on podcasts and stuff like that, and I've heard a lot of people explain them better than myself. So, you know, I think we're getting there. And then, you know, more, it's at least enough so to intrigue people, because I imagine there's some people that are like, well, that's crazy. That's not, we're not living in a simulation. That's not, you're not God. You didn't tap into anything. I'm not saying that I did. I'm just saying it's the feeling that it, that
you're just describing the experience.
And if you don't believe me that that's what it feels like, well, then you go smoke yourself some DMT and have it. And you tell me what your perception of it is. Maybe it'll be different, but you might come back to me with some questions. And, I mean, the thing is with all this stuff is our brains, we've evolved to be these storytelling apes. We tell ourselves all sorts of stories all the time. Our brain can very quickly create stories. We can create works of fiction. We can justify our own beliefs and behaviors very, very quickly. You can make up past events. People, I just had a guest on my tour, Stand Up Science, which I hope everyone checks out, which is two comedians and two scientists on the same show. So it's like half comedy, half TED Talks. I just had someone talking about implanting false memories, and you can, they do studies where they kind of get a rumor spread around a school of school children that like there's a rabbit loose in the school, and a week, and you know, it never actually happened, but a week later kids have these like incredible stories about it and all these details that they fill in. And so the brain has this propensity to do this stuff anyway, so it's definitely not to be trusted. And these psychedelic experiences are so short and so jarring that that it's definitely hard to have accurate memory of them. People's eyewitness testimonies faulty when people aren't on drugs, let alone when they are in these experiences. And you know, something like deja vu, I sometimes think, you know, you're walking around and you know we have this associative memory where we process every experience based on past experience, and so our brain is constantly accessing past experiences to make sense of our current world and make predictions about the future. And so you're walking down the street in this unfamiliar town, and but you, like, there's an uneven sidewalk, and you, without knowing it, kind of step just a little bit on this uneven, and your like left foot turns in this slight little odd way that you don't even notice happens, but that stimulation goes into your brain. Your brain needs to quickly adjust your balance, and this is all being done without your knowledge. But it reaches back into a similar experience, and when you stepped back on an uneven sidewalk that was very similar to that 15 years ago. And so coming along with that, the sense of like, oh, here's how I should regain my balance, comes that story of where you were in that moment when your foot was that way. And I think that your consciousness then goes, oh, have I been here before? And then you make up this conscious story of like this deja vu experience and this feeling like you've lived this before. And it's very likely that that's the same sort of thing that's happening. I don't know if that's how deja vu works. I'm not sure anyone knows how deja vu
works. Fuck that. That's not sexy enough. I like to think we've fucking been here before. We're living the same thing again.
Yeah, and we might be. But it's also the case that, you know, our brains and these DMT experiences or whatever are working very quickly to make sense of this completely new world of sensory experience that you find yourself in. And, you know, especially one of the telltale signs of this is for me is in a DMT experience, which is a very quick, intense, powerful, confusing, you know, often wonderful, but overwhelming experience, sensory overload that, you know, it's hard to know up from down. You often forget that you're even a human being. It can sometimes... feel like you're gone for entire lifetimes. And one of the things that I've noticed with the DMT experience, and it's been a while since I haven't had DMT since the documentary, but I've had it about 100 times in my life. And I found that, you know, it would be DMT would be changing scenes and changing worlds really quickly. And I think a lot of that was like, me being like, no, this can't be real. No, this can't be real. And so it would quick create another scene, another world, be like, how about this world then? How about this world then? I'd be like, no. Oh. And then as soon as I was like, oh, maybe this is right. And then things would like slow down a little bit and the world would become clearer and you'd kind of be absorbed into that experience. And it's not because that world's or that perception is any more real than any of the other ones. It's just that you bought into it a little bit more. And so that slowed down that conscious perception of it and elongated it. And I think that might be a metaphor for what this entire reality is. And is that this is just this conscious experience that we are buying into. And
it really slowed down.
and it's this very slowed down, grueling paced world that crawls
that away. we were okay with this one.
Yeah, I guess this is what's happening.
You did ayahuasca in the documentary, and I was a little bummed out because we didn't get to see the ceremony for what was it? It was kind of like legal purposes. It just couldn't get the crew in there. They wouldn't allow it.
That's what we said in the documentary. What really happened is my director, you know, brevity is everything. And we just wanted to tell the story in the best way possible and like get to the point of what happened. But what actually happened is that I went to go and do ayahuasca to prepare for doing ayahuasca on the documentary.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I had this powerful experience. I mean, I wish we would have just said that, but my director wanted to like make up this silly little white lie along the way just to get this shot of like me going to do ayahuasca or whatever. And so that's what happened there. So we actually shot when I'm in a car going like, oh, I'm about to go and do a clandestine ayahuasca experience. That was after the fact. So what actually, we just like shot that quick just to like fill in something, just to tell the story, just to get to the point, because it really ultimately didn't matter. But But for people watching this, now you get a little behind the scenes, a little added bonus. It might add a little something.
Little Where I Belong exclusive.
That's to to watching the documentary. I didn't really have that much respect for the intensity of ayahuasca because I had had some experiences previously that were really mild, and we are on a very low budget, and it was a huge pain in the ass to film ayahuasca. And so I wanted to make sure that I was like familiar with the batch and like knew exactly how much I was going to need to have like, you know, a strong experience. And I wanted it to be a really strong experience too. I really wanted to go for it. Because we're filming this documentary, and I didn't
right.
want like a mild ayahuasca experience, and so I was trying to find where that level was, and you know, it ended up that it was maybe the best trip I've ever had in my entire life of, I don't know, 600 trips or something like that I've probably had, and it was absolutely incredible. Unfortunately, it triggered a manic episode that I never quite came down from before needing a medical intervention eventually. And it sent me into a manic state, and I went manic for, well, a few weeks before going into a psych ward. And even after I got out of the psych ward, I was still a little manic for some time afterwards.
Right. But what I do want to say that we haven't said is, since you were doing a documentary, you went balls deep. Like you were doing a lot of things, weren't you?
Yeah.
In a very short amount of time, because you wanted to basically have as much for the documentary as possible.
And yeah.
So you weren't doing some, you know, somebody sets up this trip to have an experience doing ayahuasca. Like you, this was one of the many things on a long list of things that you had done for the documentary. And so you could argue you were at your limits in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Yeah. I was already like really with mushrooms, especially I was doing the most amount of mushrooms I'd been ever done in my life, like regularly.
Right.
Many times, sometimes like 3 times a week, which oftentimes to do like mushrooms 3 to 5 times in a year was kind of the norm for me. But, you know, I was trying to, that's another thing we didn't show in the documentary, is just how many psychedelics I was actually using at the time. I mean, the thing is there's just like, there was so much footage. There's a lot of ways we could have presented the story and shot the documentary. This is the one that we ultimately arrived at, and there's a lot of stuff that ended up on the cutting room floor. There's a lot of information and different takes and everything else that didn't get in there. It's, you know, there's only so long to tell the story, so it is what it is. But I was doing more psychedelics than we actually kind of show in the documentary.
Right. So you go and you have this experience, and you know, in the documentary, you talked about it, but what was that experience like, the ayahuasca trip?
It was beautiful. You know, I got this, it was like a mix between, it was kind of like DMT in a way that it was like a little bit seemingly in a different world and a different perception, but like also grounded in this reality. So it was kind of like the perfect mix of this world and like an outer world experience. And, you know, I got this vision. It's really kind of embarrassing to even share, because this isn't like how I think of myself or even what I think actually happened. But it is.
Well, your perception at the time.
My perception at the time was that I was getting messages from the universe about how I was like I had this role to play in communicating psychedelics to the public, which would eventually get more people interested in psychedelics and especially scientists and things like that. interested in studying them, researching them, doing them, that would kind of open up the world and create a change in this world, because kind of humanity is like off track a little bit. And, you know, it's a lot to get into. There is a whole long trip. There was some Trump stuff in there.
No.
There was all sorts of stuff.
It's a giant wall. I wanted to ask you about that, though, is, isn't it not completely unreasonable to have that experience, considering you set out to make a documentary? And so, of course, to some degree, you'd like to share this information with the public to kind of put a dent in the stigma that has been casted over psychedelics in the first place. And so it to me, it seems very reasonable to have, not to say that that wasn't, what percentage of that could have been from your own internal feelings about what you were doing, right? It just seems kind of for the par that you're setting out to do this documentary. You want people to know about it. You're how many trips in, you have this profound experience, and that's the message that you derive from it. And that seems, to me, that seems totally reasonable. I don't really see that as a, it seems like right down the path that it should have gone.
Yeah.
You know, if you were going to have an experience where something told you something profound, and that something told you, you've got to let people know for lack of elaborating, you know, then that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. What confused me was that it made some kind of predictions about what would be happening in the future. And then those things started happening like the following day. I started getting like text messages and stuff like that that were related to some of these kind of visions or prophecies or whatever that were, or seemingly related to those, that happened during this ayahuasca experience. And that's what started freaking me out initially. Initially, it was really just kind of exciting. It's just like, I guess I'm going to be some messenger or something like that.
You get to going down the right path, whatever. Right?
But, you know, eventually it became confusing. It became, you know, embarrassing to, like, share with people because I don't think I'm, like, some messiah or whatever. I certainly hope I'm not. If I'm some chosen person, then whatever's out there doing the choosing must be a pretty desperate entity. And they don't seem terribly discerning.
Right.
If you want to be chosen, just go and smoke some DMT. You just got to show up. And they're like, I choose you. And
yeah.
They're just, you know, they're recruiting, it seems like. So
do you feel any sort of, in hindsight, is it something that you look back on and it seems still irrefutable? Like the when you crunch the numbers, the chances of you having those experiences right after the trip, or is it something where you can kind of rationalize it at this point? Or is it one of those things where you just don't look at it very much because it's like, what the fuck do you even do with this information?
Yeah, a little of all those things. I'm definitely the furthest away from the perspective that like any of that was real and that I'm some sort of messenger or whatever. I'm more into the rationalizing. I think nearly 2 years since all of that stuff happened, and I don't really do psychedelics much anymore. Much more into the rationalized side of things, and often on the I don't even want to think about that anymore side of things. I mean, I had a documentary come out, and I like having these conversations and sharing my experiences on podcasts and everything, but I don't put any effort into like putting myself out there as any kind of a psychedelic spokesperson or anything like that.
Yeah,
anymore.
That's
kind of moved on to some other things.
That's one of the things that I love about you, was that so many people come away from these experiences and they really do go for that woo-woo where suddenly everybody's got to do it. But you said it very clearly in the documentary where it's like, this isn't for everybody. It's not everybody should be going out and having this, this profound experience. It's, you likened it to being an astronaut for NASA, and it's just because it is a profound experience to go to outer space and to look at the planet from up there doesn't mean that everybody should load up on rocket ships and go into outer space. It's not something that's necessarily for everybody, which is not something that you hear people often say who have had these experiences. To a lot of people, they go down this route where it's for everybody and it's the end all be all, the solution to all that ails us and all these, you know, extreme things. And it was just very interesting and honest to hear that that aspect of it. So I thought that was pretty cool. But, you know, because I thought about it myself, I've been thinking about having experiences, and I've asked some of my friends, and like I said earlier in the show, they are very reluctant. And it's just, you know, to me, the mindset that you carry into it would probably be everything, because ever since that trip that I had, it wasn't even a trip, right? I don't know if you would, well, I guess if you're experiencing MDMA, it's a trip, but I had that bad experience and I didn't do it for a number of years. And then when I actually did it again, years down the line, I went into it with this idea that like anything that happens on this is my own thoughts and my own feelings on the situation. And if that's true, then ultimately I'm more or less in control. And so I would just, if I started to feel negative or anything, I would just go into like a little bit of a breathing exercise, and suddenly everything was cleared up very quickly. But I think that, you know, if you're afraid of these things in the first place, you probably shouldn't even do them, right? Because you're carrying that with you into the experience, and or at least know that there's a high chance you're going to have a potentially scary experience. If you're afraid of this without even having done it, and then you carry that with you, you might have a frightening experience.
Yeah. I mean, I go back and forth, and I'm always playing devil's advocate. So whatever someone says, I'll just say the opposite. Because I mean, I do think that there's plenty of people out there that like are just so scared of their own inner world. And some of those people would benefit from psychedelics more than anyone else. Plus, I think there's a lot of like assholes out there that have, you know, they're masking their insecurities. And there's a lot of like, especially like, there's a lot of ego-driven, status-seeking men out there that are, in my opinion, ruining not just the rest of our lives, but their own lives probably as well, and just need to like have some of those barriers broken down a little bit. And I do wish some of those people would have an experience. But yeah, I think that if it were in this ideal world where it's a clinical setting, where in clinical settings, I mean, they're screening for things like, you know, family history of psychosis and things like that too. So definitely they're not going to be for everyone that has particular family histories. But I think in an ideal world where the drug laws are completely different than where they are now, which is basically they don't exist other than to like make sure that people are getting the products that they think that they're getting. It would be in this clinical setting, maybe get like a license or something like that. You get trained in and you're doing it with professionals, and then you and having those experiences first. I think like, why not? If you know that you're getting actual MDMA, you're doing it in a clinical setting. And I mean, I think a lot of people's relationship, I'm sure my parents would benefit from a MDMA couples counseling, and they, you know, they're good people who seem to get along well and enjoy their lives, who are definitely like very scared of these kinds of substances. I think they would benefit as well. So I mean, they're not for everybody, but at the same time, the kind of ridiculous stigma that has been perpetuated through our culture is really all backwards, because at the end of the day, it is scary when you see someone like me lose my mind end up in a psych ward for a week or whatever. But I'm also, I would say I'm a better person for having had that experience. And, you know, I think that there's a lot of things. Most people are eating way too much sugar and way too much like trans fats and stuff like that. Now that might seem silly because eating a pixie stick isn't the same as losing your mind, but so few people are actually losing their minds from psychedelics and even on a very temporary basis, whereas the majority of the world is poisoning themselves in very small doses each and every day, and that's leading to a lot of unhappiness. It's leading to a lot of health problems, which then health problems lead to are the number one cause of homelessness and bankruptcy and foreclosure, as people have these unexpected health problems. And you know, you think like, well, psychedelics can make you crazy. Sugar's not going to make you crazy. Well, if people if someone's obese and then they have some heart issue and all of a sudden they have $50,000 in unforeseen medical expenses and mm-hmm. now they're homeless, well, that homelessness will make you fucking crazy.
Yeah, and now they're crazy.
I'll tell you that much.
And, exactly.
And that really is something that that happens in pretty high rates in our world, where people, even as just in terms of the amount of needless anxiety and depression, and lack of well-being and lack of enjoying ourselves that we're all doing in our modern sedentary lifestyle with poor diets, are as much of a threat to anyone. And no one's banning. I mean, there's a couple countries out there banning trans fats, but no one's out there banning these substances. They're encouraged.
Yeah, they're in everything. You know, sugar's in practically everything that you're going to eat. Off the supermarket shelf, you know. So we just did an hour and a half. I just want to thank you, Shane, for giving you your time. And can you let the folks know where they can find you, where they can find Psychonautics as well?
Well, you can go to psychonauticsfilm.com to see a preview and get more info about the film. If you're on the fence and you just haven't quite committed, you're not sure if you want to watch, you sat through this hour and 45 minute conversation all the way to the end, but you're still on the fence of whether you want to watch this thing. You can watch the preview there and you can see all of the places that you can see it. But, you know, the main places are iTunes and Amazon or Google Play are like the three big ones, but also like Xbox and PlayStation. And then there's a myriad of other, you know, different cable provider on demand things that you can see it and stuff like that. So if you're like, I'm not interested in iTunes, Amazon or Google Play or PlayStation or Xbox, well, there's still several other options out there. If you go to psychonauticsfilm.com, probably the best thing to do would go to Shane. It would be to go to Shane Moss, MAUSS.com. That has all my information to everything, including my science podcast, Here We Are, where I interview a different scientist, mostly about why we behave the way we do. A lot of psychologists, sociologists, neuroscientists, behavioral economics people, that sort of thing. And new episode each week. There's about 210 episodes up right now. And you can check that out. And I also have a tour, Stand Up Science, which is me and a different comedian in every city, and joined by two scientists. It's half comedy, half science. It's comedy, TED Talk, kind of is the format. And then all four of us together on stage at the end, led by, and I moderate a panel that's led mostly by audiences' questions. And I'm going all over the country with that. You're going to look at my schedule and you're going to be like, oh, I missed it. You were in my city and I missed it. But I'm going, it's a regular tour that it's a different show each time. So I'm regularly cycling back through all of these cities and we'll be coming to a city near you soon.
All right. Well, thank you guys so much for listening to Where I Belong. As always, you can head over to whereibelongpodcast.com. You'll have access to all the links for my social media, as well as iTunes, Spotify, and YouTube. And if you're looking for a way to support the show, just click on the link to the Patreon, and you could do so there. Thank you so much, Shane, for your time. I really appreciate it, man.
Thank you. It was great.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Have a good one.
Thanks.
You live and you learn and then there's nothing you could do to stop the impending doom of you and everyone you love dying. Where I Belong Podcast.